Welcome to Anatomy on the Beach. This is Dr. Leo Stouter, right by the beach, and we're going to step away just a little bit so we can talk to you without having a lot of that rushing about. I want to talk first about the major themes of anatomy and physiology. Now, these major themes are going to be wrapped around two concepts. One concept is going to be the study of form. We call this anatomy. The other one is going to be the study of function. We call this the physiology. So physiology is really going to be that aspect of anatomy where we're going to be talking about how the structure actually functions. So when we look at such things as, for instance, things that would be very, very common. Now, we don't really want to name what this structure is, but we're going to be just saying that it has a definite anatomy, it has a definite form, and we know that just by looking at it, it can almost be that we could see that it has an actual function. And that function, given the fact that it looks like it could stab things, that function would be then to stab something. And in this case, of course, it being a fork, we expect it then to be able to be, we'd be able to stab, for instance, meat with that, with those points that we see there. Now we see that we have, of the fork, we have an anatomy, we have a form. And that form then would be the listed structures there. For instance, the points would be the ends of the tines. So we see a tine has then the anatomy at the end being the point. Between the tines, we see that we have a slot. So the area that is defined by the two tines would be a slot. We also see that at the end of the tines are going to be the roots. And also, the roots then will be culminated as we go further back into a neck. And that neck then will then become a handle. So we can see that the form of the handle tells us that we're able to grasp that. So that's going to be the physiology of the fork, if you will. And grasping the physiology of the fork, we'll be able to then to take the points and stick them in something like a nice meal. We also see at the lower part that this is what we would consider a lateral view. And a lateral view of the fork would have a back. So we can see how that little area that sort of slopes would be considered the back. So we have the anatomy of the fork, not only an A to P view, which would be the top part, or an anterior to posterior view, but also a lateral view as we see on the bottom. Put these two together and we can see that they're sort of almost three-dimensional. And sort of see that the areas just above the root actually have a little bit of a slope called the back. So if we were to be able to go to, for instance, a fork conference where we were endeavoring to talk about the fork, for whatever reason, we're manufacturers, let's say, we would be able to communicate with our other compadres about the fork because we would have a common language. We would have a common anatomy. And we could say such things as, I'm having real problems with my points. And the guy would, come in and say, well, the reason that is probably because your tines aren't thick enough. He goes, yeah, I had noticed that my tines weren't thick enough because my slots were off. He goes, yeah, and if you change the back, then that's going to assist you in, changing your neck, which then may help with the manufacturing of your points. So they could talk about the fork because they have a common language or they have a common anatomy. And that's really what you're going to be doing in this study of anatomy. You're going to be looking at different words that are going to be defining certain structures. And also you're going to be looking at certain functions with a vocabulary that's also going to describe those. So really what our study is going to be about is trying to define what these terms are so we can have a common language and a common understanding. Our common language is going to give us a pictures of certain things or certainly concepts. And these concepts or pictures will be of benefit later on when we want to integrate them into the true functioning that we're going to be using when we're going to use them in our profession. Whatever our profession is going to be, medical or dental or chiropractic or whatever. Now the human structure is going to have a level of structural organization. We're going to look at, first of all, the fact that we could have a bunch of chemicals that are going to get together, if you will. Remember, if you take an atom, that's going to be like an element. Take an element and add it to another element. We get a molecule. And then take that molecule and now make it even more complex. Now we have a macro or a bigger molecule. Take that bigger molecule, that macromolecule, and actually allow it to be organized. Now we have an organelle, the organized organelle. It's a small organ that's going to be existing in the cell. And the cell then is going to be our first living component. The chemical aspect is non-living, but it still is going to culminate in living, which is going to be the cell. Put enough cells together and we're going to have a tissue. Organize enough tissues, we're going to have an organ. And of course the term organ, organize. So we have enough tissues together that are organized into an organ. Enough organs, we get a system. And then, of course, our systems together work for the good of the organism, or that grand organized structure we would call the body. So we see if we go from chemical to organism, we're going from simplest to the most complex. When we look at the 11 systems of the human body, we see that we're going to have the urinary system. The urinary system will work in concert with the reproductive system, which will work with the integumentary system, which will work with the skeletal system, which will work with all the other systems that we see listed. So the system then is going to work, these systems are going to work together for the good of the organism, which is represented by that individual in the middle. These different organ systems are listed. We have just one word that's going to be describing them, or it's going to be sort of a hallmark of them, if you will. Even though they are a system, and the system's going to be a combination of many different organs, really we can just look at one organ as being typical for these systems, just so we can sort of get a handle on them, so we can sort of understand them, and then utilize them later if it happens to occur on a test or someplace like that. So the integumentary system will have as its primary organ the skin. Skeletal system would be bone. Muscular system would be muscles. Lymphatic system would be lymphatic vessels. The respiratory system, lungs. The urinary system, kidneys. The nervous system, brain. The endocrine system, the hypothalamus, which is an endocrine organ. Circulatory system would be the heart. The digestive system would be the small intestine. That would be one nice organ to remember for the digestive system. And the reproductive system would be the uterus. So those would be some primary organs that we can look at for those different systems. Now, the phenomena of anatomy is that we're going to be talking about really things that are standard throughout the body. So really what we're going to be studying is the aspect that we are all basically the same. And that's really not true. We assume that we're talking about normal, quote-unquote, normal anatomy, and we are, but we're not going to be talking about the individual variances. But we are going to talk about it now so that you understand from the beginning that we all vary. We basically are 70% the same, and we're 30% a little bit off. Now, what does that mean, a little bit off? Well, it doesn't mean that we're abnormal. Abnormal is not an anomaly. An anomaly is something that is out of what we would consider the same throughout. So it's out of that, so it's not abnormal, though. What it is going to be a variance of what is usual, let's say. So, for instance, a real good example is a missing organ. If you will put your thumb and small finger together and push, and then flex your wrist a little bit, you'll see that a tendon will come out right in the middle of your wrist. Do the same with both hands and do the same thing. You may notice that you don't have this muscle called the palmaris longus on one or the other hand, or you'll notice that you have them on both hands, or you may notice that you don't even have the tendon. This is often missing in individuals. In my case, I don't have one on the right side, but I do on the left. And obviously, I've spent my career being a chiropractor over 28 years, and obviously it did not cause any disability because I was able to practice all that time. So we're not looking at this as a abnormality. What we are looking at it as is a anomaly. And once again, anomaly is just going to be a deviation from what is quote-unquote normal. We can also have more or less organs than normal. I have 6 lumbar vertebrae, for instance. So that means I have an extra lumbar. We also have 4 wisdom teeth usually, but I have 5 wisdom teeth. So even though I had five wisdom teeth, that doesn't make me abnormal. That just says that I have an anomaly. We also can have variations in organ locations. Now, a variation in organ locations would be abnormal unless each of the organs did the same. So in other words, let's say that all of our organs decided to get up and turn around and go to the other side. So all of your organs got up and turned around and went to the other side. So your appendix is no longer on your right side. It's now on your left side. Your right kidney is now on your right. Or your right kidney is now on your left, and your left kidney is now on your right. Your heart's no longer on the right side, or left side. It's now on the right side. So all your organs get up and turn around. We call this situs inversus. Situs inversus means that all of your organs are shifted. I once had a patient who was 92 years old and had situs inversus. So it obviously does not compromise, you know, who you are as far as, or compromise as far as your age is concerned. Also, it was fun the first time that I examined him. I'm listening for his heart and he's chuckling. And I'm saying, you know, please don't chuckle. I can't really hear with you chuckling. It reverberates in your chest. So he kept chuckling and chuckling. I said, what are you chuckling about? He goes, well, you're not going to find my heart there. And I said, why? He says, because I have some condition. I forget what it's called, but I have this condition where all my organs are on the other side. And sure enough, I looked on the other side and could hear his heart really, really well. So he had situs inversus. So he had a mirror image of your quote-unquote normal. Now, was he abnormal? No, he had an anomaly. And obviously it didn't cause him any problems. I think he lived to be 95. Now, a problem can be if we have situs perversus. Now, the word pervert, to pervert, is obviously not good. So situs perversus means that just one organ has done this twisting. So if the heart twists, we call this situs perversus. If the testicles twist, we call this situs perversus. If the kidney twists, we call this situs perversus. And over the umbrella of situs perversus could be these certain terms that will define which organ has gone, if you will, perverse. So in this case, underneath situs perversus, we could have the heart turning. We call this dextrocardia. Dextro means right. Cardia means heart. So literally, it's the heart on the right side. The problem with this is that the rest of the organs did not go with it, so therefore the plumbing is going to be off. The individual is going to have some problems usually. Now, this will be called a pathology and not just an anomaly. Sometimes it is just an anomaly because a person can function just properly without worrying about it. But sometimes there is problems because of the situs perversus. Now, when we look at anatomy, we have to look at what is anatomy functioning in. And, of course, it's functioning in life. So we have to look at the characteristics of life. First of all, the characteristics of life have to have organization. Now, we just mentioned that when we mentioned about the different organs, the different tissues, how to organize into organs, the different organs, how to organize into systems. So we see fundamentally that we have this organization that is key to life. Also, we have to have cells. The cell theory is that all structure and function results from the activity of cells. And that's our basic biological theory that we deal with day in and day out. We believe that all things have as their core, all living things have as their core cells. So the cell is the fundamental unit of all life. So cellular composition is significant for us to call something living. We also have to have metabolism. This is a characteristic of life that we have to have to make life continue. So we have to have a breaking down and we have to have a building up. The breaking down is called catabolism. the building up is called anabolism. So catabolism is a breaking down. So like, let's say for breakfast we had an egg. So this egg is going to be broken down into its component parts, which are amino acids. These amino acids then are going to help to build up your body. We can use those amino acids to make muscle or to make other cells in your body. So you know, you've heard the term, you are what you eat. You are, because anything that you eat is going to be broken down, and some of it can be used to make your body. That doesn't mean that you're a chicken. That just means that you're going to be utilizing those components. So the breaking down, catabolism, and the building up is going to be anabolism. So we take those amino acids that we got from the protein, broke them down through catabolism. We then take those amino acids and build them up into our cells, into our muscle. And that's going to be called anabolism. Now, responsiveness is going to be where we can respond to our environment. Usually we use nerves for this. So if a person's responsive to their environment, we know that they're alive. So if you get really cold, you shiver. If you get really hot, you sweat. So you're responding to your environment. Movement and growth is significant for life. Also, differentiation is important. We go from non-specialized or unspecialized to specialized. We go from stem cells to specialized cells. So we go from cells that really don't know what they want to be when they grow up to cells that actually know what they want to be when they grow up. So we're going from unspecialized to specialized, and this is significant. This, of course, occurs with mitosis and other body processes. We also have to have a form of reproduction. Now, I've never had kids, so you could say I'm not alive because I don't fulfill this characteristic of life, but that's not what they're talking about. They're not talking about the fact that you can reproduce. They're talking about the fact that you do reproduce. And I just mentioned that, how this happens, and that's through mitosis. We have to reproduce our body cells for us to maintain our life. So that's what they mean by this kind of reproduction. Also, in addition, we do need, as a species, to reproduce ourselves so that life can continue. So even though I haven't had any kids, other people have made up for it. So the species still continues. We also have excretion, which is going to be getting rid of waste products. That's important. We can't have waste building up in our bodies. And we also have a phenomenon called homeostasis. Homeo means the same state. So we need to maintain the same state so that we can survive. So, for instance, our blood is going to be a certain pH. It's not going to go acid or it's not going to go base. It's going to be almost neutral. So your body constantly tries to maintain this homeostasis of your blood. It also maintains a bunch of other things to keep them at a steady state. So homeostasis is a very important concept. And it means maintaining physiological balance. Hippocrates noted that a body normally returns to a state of equilibrium by itself. It needs to detect the change and oppose it, or detect the change and somehow modify it. So the regulation of homeostasis is really two ways. We have a fast way, which is going to be our nervous system, and a slower way, which is going to be the endocrine system. Now, any female will tell you that the endocrine system takes time to work. She knows when she's going to have her period, she gets a little knock on the door. But it's not like it's a blazing person that comes right straight through. It's just a little knock on the door. And then a few days later, it gets more intense and more intense and more intense. So it's a slow acting process. So we have both a fast nervous and a slower endocrine system. So this is going to help us to maintain this physiological balance. If we lose this homeostatic control, this could cause illness or death. Picture a teeter-totter. If you have a person that weighs 50 pounds on one end and 50 pounds on the other, we're at equilibrium or we're at homeostasis. But now I have a person who weighs 100 pounds and another person who weighs 50. You can see that we're going to be off, that the 100 pounds are going to be weighing down the 50-pound person. This would be like illness. Now imagine that the person weighs 200 pounds and there's nobody on the other end. This would be like disease. And now let's say that there's nobody there, but the teeter-totter is totally off its kilter. That would be like death. So death is going to be a total loss of homeostatic control. Illness is going to be a temporary loss of homeostatic control, only temporary, because the person will come back into balance, back into homeostasis, and back into health. So disease then is going to be homeostatic imbalance. And we tend not to want to treat a disease because that's just the imbalance. We'd rather treat the person who has the disease. A good example would be a person who is very, very high strung and you give him a pill for his high blood pressure. It'd be better if we treated the individual and said maybe we need to take some time out. Maybe we need to have you pray more. Maybe we need to have you meditate. Maybe we need to have you exercise more. Maybe we need other things. Maybe you need to decrease your coffee. I mean, other things that we can do to assist this individual rather than just have a pill for every ill. So when we look at the feedback system, we see that we're going to try to maintain homeostasis. So there's a feedback system. We have to know if something's out of balance in order to put it back in balance. So we have both a negative and a positive feedback. Now the negative feedback is going to be where we get a stimulus and we respond in a way that affects or decreases that stimulus. We're trying to subtract from the stimulus. So if we have high blood pressure, what would we do to that? Well, we would want to lower it. So we want to subtract from that high blood pressure or make it low blood pressure. If we had low blood pressure, we'd want to subtract from that to make it high blood pressure. So if you have cold, you want to mitigate that. You want to subtract from that. What do you subtract from cold? You get heat. What happens if you're too hot? You want to subtract from that. You want to become cold. So the negative feedback is always going to be affecting the stimulus in a negative way. We don't mean negative in a judgmental way. We mean negative in an opposite sort of way. This is the most common kind of feedback that we can get. So if I were, for instance, teaching and I saw the class sleeping, that would be negative feedback to me. Not negative in the sense that it would be wrong, but negative in the sense that I'm going to want to mitigate that situation. So I'm going to talk a little bit louder, maybe. I'm going to be more animated. I'm going to try to make my lectures more interesting so that I can counter that negative, so I can make it a positive. So I can counter that negative by doing the same, and you're going to get the same. I don't want to do that. I want to do opposite. So since I was not as lively, I'm going to be more lively. Since I was not as humorous, I'm going to try to be more humorous. Since I was not as animated, I want to be more animated. So you see how we're going to be doing just the opposite to try to mitigate this feedback. Now the same could occur that everybody's having a good time in my class. We're all joking. We're all sharing. Everybody's discussing the topic. I would not want to change that. What I would want to do is encourage that. So that would be like positive feedback. Positive feedback is where we want to actually add to the situation. So we're going to add in a positive way. We're going to increase the stimulation. I'm going to do more and more things that are going to encourage that kind of behavior that's occurring in the class. Because I want to have discussion. I want to have individuals interested. I want to have people that are going to enjoy the process of learning anatomy. So I'm going to add to that situation. That's what positive feedback does. The best example of that is going to be labor. In labor, we have a child who is pushing against the cervix. That causes discomfort to the woman and also causes a neurological increase or neurological impulse to go to the brain. And once it goes to the brain, this neurological impulse will stimulate the release of a hormone called oxytocin. Oxytocin then will go to the uterine wall and will cause contraction of the muscle. So now you get more contraction of the muscle, which pushes the head against the cervix even more. This causes more discomfort. The increase of nervous impulse again goes to the brain, causing more release of oxytocin. And you see how more equals more is more and more until ultimately the kid pops out. So the positive feedback loop is going to be where we have physiological changes that lead to an even greater change in the same direction. It's self-amplifying. So if I were to look at a bottle of water, for instance, open that bottle of water, and then drink half of it, that would be an example of positive or negative feedback. Well, we haven't done anything to it yet, have we? We had it full, and now it's half full. That means it was high, and now it's low. Obviously, negative feedback. Now what I decide to do is add more water to it, just to where it was before. So now you have it at half, it used to be at full, so now we're going to negative feedback. But now I add water and water and water, and the water starts to overflow in the bottle. This then would be an example of positive feedback, because we're increasing it over and over and over and over and over. If we have low and we raise it just to where it was, negative feedback. If we have high and we lower it, that's negative feedback. If we have low and we raise it, that's going to be a positive feedback. So when we look at some medical terms, we have to see that these medical terms are going to assist us because it's our language we're able to use to express our thoughts. So when we look at the word diagnosis, we see di is going to be two. Agnosis means guesses. So it's really two guesses. So when a person gets a diagnosis, it's his best guess. The Mayo Clinic is 50% incorrect on autopsy. So their diagnoses are about 50% accurate, or shall we say 50% inaccurate. So what do we go with? How can we make our diagnosis better? Well, one of the best ways is to use a medical history. Spend the time to actually find out what's going on with the patient. 90% of a diagnosis should come from a medical history. Find out what's going on with the individual. How do we make a good exam? How do we make a better diagnosis? We can do a physical exam. We can do tests. But we never do tests to give us a diagnosis. We only do tests to support a diagnosis. So we've listened to the patient. We've done our physical exam. And we think the person has cancer. So we want to do a test to rule out or rule in cancer. So we would do, for instance, a non-specific inflammation test. Maybe we would do an X-ray. Maybe we'd do a CAT scan. But what we would not do is this. We would not say, oh, I don't know what's going on with this person. I have no friggin' idea. But what I want to do then is I'm going to do some tests. So I'm going to do all these things, blood tests and everything else. But you don't know what you're looking for. How do you know you're going to find it? So it's better to have an idea and then to do tests to either rule out or rule that in. Now, as far as treatment's concerned, we're going to use pharmacology. We aren't, but a lot of individuals use pharmacology. Your doctor will probably use pharmacology. Pharmakon is a Greek word that means poison. So poisons and medicines are oftentimes the same substance given with different intent. So we know that the thing we're giving is toxic, but we're giving it for a specific reason. An example would be, for instance, a person has heart failure. Part of their heart's not working properly and never will. We can give them a drug called Digitalis. Digitalis would be a drug then that would be a toxin. So the body wants to get rid of it as soon as it can. Best way to get rid of this toxin would be to increase the heart rate. So the side effect, because it's a toxin, would be a positive thing by increasing the amount of the heart beating and the strength of it, the heart beating. So the person's heart failure is not felt as much. Of course, this is going to continue until ultimately the heart does fail. But we have to weigh the consequences. This is what we always have to do. It's almost like a scale. You know, the positive thing is that the person's not going to live as long. I mean, that's a negative thing. But the positive thing is that their quality of life, although shorter, is going to be better. But some people don't want that. Some people say, I don't care. I don't care if I'm sick, 100 days. I don't care. I want to live those 100 days. If you're telling me I'm going to be feeling good for 50 days and die, then I don't want that. I want to live as long as I can. That's the patient's prerogative. So, we have to weigh these things, though, with each drug. Viagra, for instance. With Viagra, you can have sex if you're a male, if you have problems with erection. But the downside is that you could die from the drug. It could kill you. It could cause a heart attack. So you got to weigh, do you want sex or do you want to die? You just have to weigh these things. And that's what we always do with drugs. We have to weigh the positives with the negatives and see which one you want. Now, in medical imaging, we see viewing the inside of the body without surgery is going to be the major reason for doing this. We want to view the inside of the body so that we can support our diagnosis. We use radiography, which is going to be the x-rays discovered by William Rankin way back in 1895, same year that chiropractic was discovered. We are going to look at the radiography so that we can see what dense tissue is doing, such as bone and teeth and dense tumors. So these will not be penetrated by the x-rays. The non-dense tissue will be penetrated, so they won't show up. So for instance, if we're looking at the lateral cervical spine, the skull, the teeth, we can see those because the soft tissue does not show up, because the soft tissue allows the x-rays to pass through them, whereas the denser tissue is going to stop the x-rays, so therefore we can see it. If we want to see something in a fluid medium, we're going to use some stenography. If we want to see something that's going to be giving us a slice of the body, we'll use a CT scan. Or if we want to see soft tissue really well, we'll use an MRI. If we want to see contrast, in other words, if we want to see blood vessels, if we want to see certain body cavities, we would inject or have the person swallow a certain substance. Like, let's say we want to see the stomach, so we have them swallow barium, for instance. Okay, this fills the hollow structures, and this allows us to see better. So we're using medical imaging with contrast. And you can use this with an MRI, with a CAT scan, even with an x-ray if you're taking it out of the GI tract. Also, if we want to know what activity of the tissue is doing, we can use a PET scan. Now, the PET scan is going to be where we actually inject radioactively labeled glucose. And when the body uses more and more energy, it's going to use more and more glucose. So the more glucose it uses, that area will light up more. So if a person has a tumor, if a person has a diseased heart tissue, or a person has a problem with their brain activity, we'll be able to see the variances of what's going on in the brain, for instance, by knowing where the activity is less or where the activity is more. So just to review, we have radiography that's going to tell us about the density, stenography, which is going to talk about fluid, the CT scan is going to tell us about a slice of the body, the MRI is going to give us the soft tissue, and the PET scan is going to tell us about activity. Thank you very much. Thank you. Let's talk about the general orientation to the human anatomy. We'd like to talk about anatomical position first. This is going to be where we're actually going to stand and have our hands forward. This is our anatomical position. Our feet are flat on the floor, and our palms of our hands are going to be forward. When we look at directional terms, we see that they're going to be relative terms. So the anatomical position is where all of these terms are going to be taken from. So we ask ourselves three questions. Is this structure anterior? Is this structure posterior? Is the structure superior or is it inferior? Is the structure medial or is the structure lateral? When we ask these three questions, we'll be able to pinpoint where most things are on the body. Like, for instance, your right eye is what to your ear? Well, is your right eye anterior or posterior to your ear? It's anterior. Okay. Is your right eye superior or inferior to your ear? Oh, let's say it's superior, slightly superior to your ear. And how about, is it medial or lateral, your eye? Your eye is going to be closer to the midline, so therefore it's going to be medial to your ear. So what we do is use these as relative terms. We're relating them to something else. So your eye to your ear. Well, let's do another one. How about your mouth to your left eye? So your mouth is going to be probably a little bit posterior, and your mouth is going to be inferior and your mouth is going to be more medial than your eyeball. So you can see how you can do this with just about any body part, except for your extremities. Now, as a common thing, what we do is we note that in the extremities, in your arms and your legs, we will not use superior and inferior. As a convention, we use proximal and distal. So your hand is not inferior to your elbow. We don't say that. We say your hand is going to be distal to your elbow. And your elbow would be proximal to your hand. See how they're still related terms? Or your knee would not be superior to your foot. We say your knee is proximal and your foot is distal. Also, we have the term ipsilateral, which means on the same side. Bilateral means both sides. We usually won't say your right and left hand. We'll say the bilateral hand. Or if we have a condition, let's say we have carpal tunnel, we'll say we have bilateral carpal tunnel. That means that you know it's in both hands. We can also talk about contralateral. This is the opposite side. So we can have a person who has, for instance, a problem with their right hand and their left foot. That would be a contralateral problem. When we look at the body, we can actually visualize that there are certain slices that we can create in the body. These slices we call planes. And from these planes, we can get a view. So when we do our medical imaging and we cut a person in a certain plane, we expect to see a certain view. If we cut a person right down the middle, so we're going right from the middle of their head through their nose to the middle of their mouth all the way down to the middle of their neck, this is going to be called a sagittal plane. Sagittal for sagging, if you will. If you took an axe and embedded it into the person's skull, the skull would sag in the middle. So the sagittal is going to be giving us a lateral view. Because if you cut the person right down their nose and through their mouth and all that, take them apart, we'll be able to see them laterally. So it gives us a lateral view. We also have a coronal view. Coronal view is going to be where we're going to go just the opposite of the sagittal. The sagittal was right through the nose. This will be right through our ears. So the sagittal, the coronal is going to be a frontal plane that's going to be cutting us in right through the ears and all the way down. And that's going to be considered then an anterior and posterior view. We'll actually be able to view the body anteriorly to posteriorly. We can also see a transverse plane where we actually cut the person right in half. So you've seen magicians that will saw a person in half. They're sawing in a transverse plane. This gives us a bird's eye view because if you cut the person, you're able to look right down at them and see a bird's eye view. If we combine sagittal and coronal, those two planes, we can get an oblique plane, which is going to give us an oblique view. So that's going to be like sort of between the coronal and the transverse. Now, when we look at body cavities, we'll see that we have really two big body cavities. We have a posterior or dorsal body cavity. These terms are synonymous, dorsal and posterior. Dorsal is the older term, and posterior is the newer term. And we also have a ventral body cavity. Ventral and anterior mean the same. So in our dorsal body cavity, we're going to have our cranial cavity and our vertebral cavity, or our vertebral canal. Our cranial cavity will have the brain. The vertebral canal will have the spinal cord. Our ventral body cavities will be the thoracic cavity, which will contain our lungs, our heart, our thymus gland. And also our diaphragm will separate the ventral body cavity into two portions. The upper portion is going to be the thoracic cavity, and that lower portion is going to be the abdominal pelvic cavity. In the abdominal pelvic cavity, we're going to have the abdominal organs such as the liver, gallbladder, your intestines, and in that lower part, we're going to have the bladder and the sex organs. Now the body is going to, or the abdomen is going to be divided into four parts. These four parts are called the right upper quadrant, the right lower quadrant, the left upper quadrant, and the left lower quadrant. We start at the xiphoid process, which is going to be just at the end of your sternum. And it's like a little stick in there. It feels like a little tip of a knife almost. We're going to start there, and then we're going to make a line going all the way through our belly button, or our umbilicus, or our navel. And that's going to take us all the way down to our pubic bone. So that's our first line. And of course, that's going to be in the sagittal plane. Then we're going to do a transverse section going from the left to the right side, passing through our umbilicus or our navel or our belly button again, and going all the way to the left side. So we're going from the right to left, and we're going to make a transverse section through there. So that whole section that's on the left side, it's going to be the left lower quadrant. On the right side, the right lower quadrant. So we're going to use these quadrants to sort of describe where certain organs are. Like, for instance, the right upper quadrant, we have the liver. In the left upper quadrant, we have the stomach. The spleen's there as well. The right lower quadrant, we have the appendix, which is very important. And then the left lower quadrant, we have parts of the intestine, we have the left ovaries in there, those kinds of things. So I want to thank you for participating in this podcast, and we'll speak to you again with Anatomy on the Beach. Bye now.